Welcome to the LSE, for those of you who are from outside, and very good to see so many members of the school community here. There are 22 different events at the LSE tonight, three in this building. So, Rob, it's very good that we've got so many people here to listen to the story of Melbourne. But really it's a story about how do you connect architecture to politics, how do you create the way that people want to live with the way that we design the spaces, but also the institutions that make spaces in cities, which is very much one of the central themes of research that LSE Cities, which is organizing this event, has been looking at for a number of years. We run a research center and contribute to teaching a master's course, which is very much about this interdisciplinary investigation into physical space and social space in many ways. And the reason why it's such a pleasure, just personally but also intellectually, to be able to host Rob today is that in many ways he's one of the guys who actually does that in the real world. I mean, sometimes the title of city architect is very technical. Sometimes it's can be grandiose. Think of people, actually didn't have that title, but Robert Moses in New York, who did some rather extraordinary things, some great and some not so great, a number of years back. But I think what Rob has done over his career in Melbourne, which we'll talk about a little bit over the last nearly 20 years there, is put many of these sort of contemporary ideas about the compact city, the livable city, really into practice, so much so that this city has become, and it's won this award many awards. Now, I really find those sorts of rankings incredibly uninteresting, so don't take this personally.
So do I.
Yeah, and the reason is that if you look at, you know, literally, Monocle, you name it, The Economist, Financial Times, you do the rankings, which are the best cities in the world, you tend to get, in no particular, and if anyone here is either Austrian or Swiss, don't get upset. But, you know, you tend to get Vienna, Zurich, Geneva, whatever. You know, all places that... Would anyone really want to live there? I mean, why would you go and live in Geneva? Unless you're a banker or something else. And I think, you know, what we're talking about here is that property of buzz of what Saskia Sassen, our colleague, calls cityness, is what one is trying to capture and recreate. And I think Melbourne happily falls somewhere in the middle of that. I mean, it's still messy in parts.
It is. Yeah.
Intentionally?
Well, I think like any city, it's not fully in control. So you still get the messy pieces.
Right. So how do... Yeah, that's an interesting point which will come up. But so Melbourne has won this accolade of most livable city a few years back. And Rob is very concerned, you know, how do we not sort of... By the way, I still don't really understand. You changed the title from Melbourne Unplugged, which I really didn't understand what it meant. But well,
neither did my daughter, who's an urban designer, and said, "What do you mean, Dad?" Right. I said, "Well, hopefully I'll explain."
Okay, but we'll come back to that. But it is all about finally re-energizing cities, taking what's there, and also thinking forward 10 years with sort of frameworks which are completely flexible and resilient, and can adapt to what's happening in sort of the social, economic, and environmental reality. Rob actually trained as an architect. He was brought up in Zimbabwe, moved to Australia, to Melbourne, after having trained, as I say, an architect in South Africa, trained as an urban designer at another institution in the UK. You're allowed to do that, a master's in urban design at Oxford Brookes. I mentioned before Robert Moses, and I think there's a lineage now in the last maybe 20 years where different architects, different sort of figures have actually had a serious imprint on what is shaping the future of their cities. And for me, Oriol Bohigas in Barcelona probably set up a sort of way of thinking about the city, which has stood the test of time over, interestingly, maybe 20, 25 years and three or four different mayors. That sort of idea of the city has been there. More recently, perhaps Amanda Burden in New York City under Bloomberg has tried to do some of the same things, sort of thinking about what the city's about. Richard Rogers, amongst others, of course, has been involved in London, and some of us have been part of that narrative. But I think it's rare to be able to have a city of a manageable size, which to a degree you've had, but one which has grown pretty astronomically, and we'll hear about that, and continues to grow, and a lot of it actually the wrong growth, suburban and car dependent. So how do you deal with that, and how do you tame that is one of the key issues. My experience of Melbourne going a few years back when I was hosted by Rosie and Rob and other friends there was, you know, yes, seeing the great spaces, Swanston Street, which is, I don't know, Oxford Street, turned into a actually incredibly pleasant, normal place, as opposed to a rather, I guess, ugly thoroughfare with shops. But it's actually, my memory was the little alleyways, which were literally forgotten for decades in your city. A beautiful piece of, I guess, typology, if one can use such a pretentious term at the LSE, of urban typology, of just physical form, which was unused. I think you were able to turn it round. So very narrow little spaces, lanes, were sort of have become part of the vibrant part of the city. And just the waterfront. I mean, access to water, of course, we know is so important. I think in Melbourne it's become a lifeblood of the city, which brings life at different times of the day and the year, and of course your climate sort of in a degree helps. And I know Terry Farrell's here and others have been thinking about how can we turn the Thames into something which is actually much more enjoyable than it is. In parts it's happening, particularly on the South Bank. So all these notions, all these aspects, these very real experiences, certainly personally, I've had on Melbourne, let alone what we read about, you have been very much part of one of the, you know, architects in more senses than one. And it's interesting that actually the group you run is effectively like an architect's office. I mean, it offers services to other parts of the city, which is, again, interesting. Designs things, doesn't just draw big arrows on plans, but actually designs things like libraries and wins awards as a result of those things. So for us at the LSE, for us in London, it's very important to hear what you have to tell us. So please join me in welcoming Rob Adams to the LSE.
Thank you. I'll try not to stand in front of you over there. Thank you for the opportunity. Ricky asked me to speak a little bit about the nature of the job I have. A lot of people don't understand it, even people who work in Melbourne. They refer to me as a city planner, which I'm not. There is a city planner that sits vertically alongside community services and all the other departments. I'm called the Director of City Design, and it is really a design practice that exists within the city. I also am responsible for the parks and gardens, which was just a quirk that got handed to me while I was away in Copenhagen. Which we've now managed to divide between those people who actually look after the parks and provide a service and maintain them. But we've taken all the other people who plan parks and put them alongside the urban designers in what's known as urban landscapes. And I'll show a bit of their work tonight. We charge fees. I don't get salaries for my staff. We actually charge fees against the projects we do. And while the account side of my division, which has 90 people in it, hate that because there's a lot of paperwork, it is one of those ways of actually keeping yourself honest, that you have to, in fact, perform within what is seen to be a reasonable fee structure. I came to Melbourne to help write a strategy, which I'll talk about, in 1983, and they asked me to stay on with an 18-month contract to implement it. 30 years later, I'm still in the middle of that, so I'll run you through that. I've called it Melbourne Unplugged. In a way, I feel that we've been a city that has actually been wired and going forward. I think we're a city that needs to stop and pause and think about coming back inward. And that's not to stop the growth, but to actually do it more sensibly. Why? Well, we know this diagram. It comes from Jeb Brugman, that we've got an urban population of 3.5 billion. And we know that in the next 40 years, it's almost going to double. So the reality of that is we've got to have twice the urban capacity in 40 years' time that we have at the moment. Down the right-hand side, 70% of the world's population will live in cities by then. They'll chug out 75 to 80% of the greenhouse gases, and they'll drive our economies. 80% of the economy is driven out of cities. Yet when I go to the World Economic Forum in about 7 days' time, we will battle to get cities onto the agenda. They're not on national government agendas. In a discussion I had with our treasurer 2 weeks ago, having given him those stats and asked him what the city's program was for the Australia, he said, it's not in my jurisdiction. And I said, 80% of the economy is not in your jurisdiction. So there's a real break between where cities should be sitting in the debate. We will talk about coal mining in Australia until the cows come home. It makes up 2% of GDP. Residential makes up 8%. Yet we won't have intelligent debates about residential. So that's really where I'm coming from. And I show this mainly because of the title, Cities of Hope. I've felt ever since 1969, when I started to worry about cities as a student, when I travelled overseas for the first time, that cities were the hope. They're the best contraceptive. As people move to cities, their family sizes drop down. If we're going to actually get to a balance on the planet, it'll be through urbanisation. And so I believe very strongly in urbanisation. The challenge is to make it a reasonable living environment, and I think that's the challenge we're faced with. I think it can be done. In the 80s, a lot of cities changed, and I worked on this with Jan Gehl, which is a report that we published in 2007 for the German government. And it looked at strategies cities had used to change themselves, and I won't dwell on it. Glasgow, that was going out in the 70s when I visited it, started to come back in on itself and changed itself from going from decentralisation to concentration, and actually in the process made it a pleasant place to live. And the city was successful. Bordeaux, in my assessment, did it on the back of a high-quality public realm. Fantastic buildings, fantastic open spaces, trams that have no overhead wires, run on induction. And you saw 190,000 people starting to use a tram system that wasn't there 10 years before that, with these incredible spaces. So that was about a quality public realm. Malmo lost its population really, its working population, when shipbuilding went to Korea. They did three things. They built a bridge to Copenhagen, put a university downtown, and built a bit of the future in Bonalit, which was a competition in 2001. Built about 120 people per hectare. They capture their water. They generate most of their electricity. But they also have created a place that actually is pleasant enough for people who want to visit and think about living there. Dublin, it's a different strategy. Temple Bar was meant to be a bus interchange. They put students in on low rentals and short leases, and students do what students do. They went to the pubs and started enjoying themselves, and other people joined them. And suddenly they started to build 12 cultural institutions that made this a really viable area, and financially quite successful in terms of the way real estate went. So successful on the back of a cultural revolution. I managed to slip two other cities in, Bogota, one because I admired the two mayors, Marcos and Henri Penaloza, who changed their city, one through a cultural change, and Penaloza through not spending a single dollar on the motor car in his first 3 years in office. That he spent it on bike paths, libraries, schools, a social infrastructure, and dropped the crime rate in that city quite dramatically. And there have been other acts of courage. In Seoul, the stream that runs under this was reinstated when they pulled down the freeway for the Olympics. I was in Rio 2 weeks ago and was delighted to see this freeway coming down between the dock and the city. And we've seen places like Aarhus in Copenhagen, which is a well-known example, where they dug up the street to reclaim the river and brought back people. Because if we're going to measure cities, we're going to measure them on the back of people. How many people are actually coming to this place? There are some traps in this one, and one of the cities I put in was Bilbao, and I was slightly reluctant to put this into the publication because I think there's a feeling that architecture can actually just turn a city around. And as much as I'm a passionate architect, it can't. And I'm not saying that Bilbao was about architecture. It was about much more than that. It was about the subway system that Foster put in and Calatrava's bridges and connections. But I think a lot of people have got trapped in this thing that maybe architecture is the silver bullet for cities. And in 2006, I went to the Venice Biennale and was fortunate enough to see Ricky Burdett's fantastic exhibition of cities. Had I turned to the left, I went into a room where Foster and Piano were actually selling this vision of a city, something that started five floors above the ground and had a ditch under it, and clearly hadn't created a public realm. Whereas on the other side, if you turned right, there was this intelligent... Sorry? Not part of your show. No. In fact, if you turned left, you made the biggest mistake of your life. If you turned right, you had this incredibly intellectual but well-communicated message. And that's the thing that we, I think, we lack, is we sometimes don't know how to communicate the message. When you walked into this room, the lady standing in the back there is standing by Barcelona. Suddenly, you visualize the density of Barcelona against London, Istanbul, Mexico City. And the realization that a city that's only seven stories high can be one of the densest in the world. Carrick sits over here. The other cities down there are the Australian cities. So, completely different density. And, as I said, seven stories high. So, this whole debate about density in cities is quite an interesting one. In Melbourne, we went through this process of change in the 80s, and most of what I've been dealing with is the central city, and this was an article written by one of the architectural journalists, Norman Day, which criticised the city as being empty and useless. And in the 1980s, it was that. It closed on an evening, and over the weekend, very few people used to go downtown. It was a suburban city. I was employed as one of five to help write the strategy plan in 85, and I did the urban design section of it. And really, the vision that we came down with, well, the politicians handed us, and I've got to give credit to the politicians, because it's the reason Melbourne's been successful, is they wanted a 24-hour city, but they wanted it to look and feel like Melbourne. And that was the secret, in a way, that it had to look and feel like Melbourne, not some other place. I'm going to take you through how I think we repurposing our city, and have a look at some of those qualities on the way through. I'm starting with density because it's the dirty word nowadays. We can't mention density in Melbourne anymore because there are a lot of people who are against it. But density is, in fact, one of the things that saved Melbourne. In 92, part of our strategy in 85 was that we bring 8,000 people back to the central city to live within the next 15 years. And that opportunity came when the property market crashed in the late 80s. And what that meant is we could put in place a program that used a lot of the old buildings and repurposed them for residential. Buildings like this that were in receivership, we managed to fall into bed with Macquarie Bank, and James Kerrin, who was one of their property directors, designed 35 units, or he didn't, he had an architect design 35 units within this building and sold them off the plan before any building was done. And he sold them all within 2 months. That really changed the way people perceived about living in the city. I was told Australians don't live downtown. A lot of the buildings that were saved were historic buildings that had been empty above ground level because the retail rentals were supporting them. And very quickly it took off, and we ended up just being a guiding force for it. In fact, we designed very little other than one of the first pilot buildings, which was one of the first I showed you. Buildings like this became repurposed. Office buildings were turned into residential buildings and added to on the top of them. And buildings like this, a fairly ordinary little hotel in Lygon Street, got completely refinanced, where every room was sold off. And then the hotel took over and guaranteed a return on those rooms. And the hotel became what you see there. It's exactly the same structure, opened up at ground level, and became quite a good contributor to the street. And we got new buildings. People like Nonda Katsalidis built new buildings and converted buildings. So this building you're seeing here is in fact the one you're seeing over there. It wasn't demolished. It was repurposed into residential. And this is what happened in 1982. Each one of those red dots, if you can see them, is five dwellings. And slowly this stuff took off. And it substantially changed the nature of our city. That is a completely different city today, on the back of now a residential population that's gone from 650 to 28,000 residential units. The city's alive. In fact, recent studies we've shown has shown that Saturday night is almost as busy in Swanson Street as during a weekday. And that dramatic change in the residential population has meant that the city has got, you know, cafes, restaurants, and that, and I'll come back to that. What it also did, because a lot of these buildings were in strata title, and this is quite an early slide, it started to consolidate the typology or the morphology of the city by these very small buildings that were in amongst the blocks, making it very difficult to consolidate large blocks and get those really large developments. And they were also, in many cases, located along the lanes. So we got our population back, and people started to write nice things about it. With that came a mixed use, and one of the things we did was to measure everything we did, and we went into association with Jan Gehl, who came over in 94 and helped us measure the first 10 years, and then has come back every decade to help us improve on that. And that showed us how the city had moved. So, you know, if you talk about food and beverage, you can see where we were in 82, 92, 2002, and we've just done the 2012. So we were starting to get quite a good cross-section of you know, food and beverage in the city, going from 604 up to nearly 2,000 over that period. The same happened with retail. Retail was one of the things we noticed we were losing in the 80s, and were fearful that we would lose it to the suburbs completely. And you can see in these figures it actually did go down for a while after we started the strategy, but fortunately, I'm able to say, it started to come back quite strongly. And we now have what was a declining trend. We now have in the centre of Melbourne one of the biggest retail shopping offers of any suburban shopping centre. So Chadstone, which people might or might not know, is a huge suburban shopping centre, is starting to worry about what's happening in retailing downtown. And these were the sort of stats that we started to get about dramatic changes in the city in terms of percentage of change. And the newspapers obviously started to write good things. But there's another side to this, and it's a side that I'm slightly worried about. And this is a shot which I show of Melbourne rather unflatteringly about some of the residential that's going up. So that fantastic Victorian city that has that combination of the old and the new and was being done quite sensitively is starting to look a little bit like this in parts. The early parts of Postcode 3000, you can see old buildings were repurposed. In this case, a couple of buildings added to, made a small hotel. New buildings, the ones I mentioned, Nonda Katsalidis. Even in the Docklands, there was a sort of an understanding about trying to get a proportion in the street, so you got the podium with the towers behind. And prefabricated. We've gone into unitized development, and they're dropping, the cost of residentials dropped by about 25%. On an admission by a local developer by unitizing the development and saving on the construction costs. This is what's happened in the central city. So there's been a lot of development happened in the central city, but two large areas, South Bank and Docklands, and two areas that we were taken out of. We're not the planning authority, the state government's the planning authority, and we were taken out of both of those areas, and they became in a way where developers were allowed to just really do their own thing to a certain extent. And we started to get, you know, buildings slightly taller coming straight off the street, Eureka Tower. You can see what's happening, which I think has a deadening effect. You're getting car parks going up for 5 or 6 stories, and then the residential above. And what that starts to do to a city, apart from changing the form of it, is... And sorry, I'll get to that. These are the number of current residential permits that have been given. And the minister's given something like 120 permits in 4 years. These are the permits, and I don't expect you to read it, but if you know what a plot ratio or is a floor area factor, one of those buildings has 1 in 60. So it's 60 times the site area is being developed. And that's been given away without any net benefit coming back to the community. We get 5% for open space, but it's 5% of the site area. So you can imagine a very small site with a plot ratio of 1 to 60, you get very little back. So the value that's being lost through this process, where developers are being given huge profits on their site, is not being captured. And what's happening is the buildings aren't actually being built. They're being flipped. So once they've got the planning permit, it's actually sold into money that's coming into the country, and development actually is then, 17 million in one case went straight to a developer who got a planning permit on a very small site, and is now that site's labored with that cost. You can see the sort of thing that's happening. This is where Postcode 3000 started. This was a building we thought would never be developed because it was such a small footprint. There's only one apartment on each level, and we're getting these pencil-thin towers that are going up. In fact, one of the big accounting firms owned that building, and they'd actually bought the air rights over the buildings in front, but they hadn't imagined that would happen in front of them, so they were a little disappointed. This is what you're getting. This is a street. So it's an interesting to, if you worry about the public realm, which I do, it's interesting to think about 120 permits, all of that sort of proportion, how that's going to change central Melbourne. These are some of the ones that have started to be built. Very small sites, very slim, architecturally, mostly in many ways, quite interesting, I must admit. When I come down the street every now and again, I look at that, and if it was going to be by itself, it would have been all right, but I know there are about four or five next to it. In 1 year, the green dots there are the permits that have been given. So the diagram you're seeing here is from an exhibition I did last November, and I've just added in the green dots of permits that have been issued since then. So we're on a fast track to changing our city. What's that doing to the city? Well, if you look at the land parcels, central city, quite small, South Bank, they get a bit bigger, and then Docklands. But the interesting thing is the number of activities in these. So if you take essential land uses, things like community services, education, health, etc., you can see the normal central city, and you can start to see what's happening. We're starting to get this monoculture that's coming in to the city. These are doorways. So if you measure, take Jane Jacobs and talk about doors and windows on the street, And suddenly you can see South Bank has a paucity of those. You've got one building here with one entrance onto that street. Quality of street facades, which is one of the measurements we take, and you can see blue is sea gray. So we're getting this slow accumulation of a poor street environment. The upper facades, a lot of these would be car parks. Maybe five or six stories before you got to a human being. What it means is we've got large areas of city like this that have been developed, and this is our Docklands, which doesn't have the activity of the central city. And belatedly, we've been called back into this and asked to, in fact, now try and add some of those activities in, which is very hard, particularly since the money's already gone. The developers were meant to contribute to this infrastructure on the way through, but miraculously, none of it's there. So this is a library we've just finished. There's an association with Kerry and Lindsay Clare, who are some very good architects. It's completely timber, prefabricated. You can see from the inside. It was the first six-star Green Star library in Australia. Public open space we're adding back in. Small things, community gardens and a little shed for them to operate out of. Temporary gardens while we look at the waterfront. Simple connections, a bridge underneath a freeway that runs over here so you can actually get into Docklands as a pedestrian or a cyclist. All of those things are having to be retrofitted into these areas. Why? Because you want people to come down and actually enjoy those areas, and Docklands was getting a very bad name as an area that was deserted. If you value a city, then one of the qualities is going to be the public realm. And one of the things that we looked at very closely back in 83 is, what is the public realm of the city? Obviously, it's all the parks and gardens, if you're lucky enough to have water, it's the water. But streets make up 80%. So the one-liner is, you design a good street, you design a good city. And I'll leave that with you to think about, because you mostly think of the city you've enjoyed the most, and it'll be because the street experience. was one that actually kept you walking through and you enjoyed. So we looked at the various patterns that made up the public realm. We've overlaid some values on those. It's not about a museum. We want continuity and change, so we want a combination of the old and new. We want sustainability, and we want a good fit with people's intentions. And we've had to retrofit a lot of the city. So our city started on a river. You can see in the top slide there was a waterfall, natural harbour that was created. That natural harbour was well connected to the city. The streets ran down, and you had the harbour. Like most cities, we got rid of all of that. We built a bridge between one traffic light and another, and we put car parks on the other side, and we really lost that connection with our river. When we came back in 83 and started looking at this, it was a case of not being able to knock this infrastructure down, so you had to change it. So all we've done here is lower the ground level, make these slightly more elegant, put in a blue light, open it up, so visibly it became more of a sculptural element and was slightly more attractive for people to go to. Very little money, but changed the nature of it. We looked at what had happened before. This is how the docks used to be. They used to have buildings running underneath those viaducts, so you've got decent streets running down. And we started to do that. So in 85, you get a situation like this. By the time we got to 98, we'd convinced people to cut a hole back in the river and to get rid of a lot of the roads and the car parks and to start building under the freeway. When the Commonwealth Games comes along, you convince the next premier that he can get rid of this road and we can come back down to ground, and then you can build the fabric back in. So 25 years after you've started, you start to get that connection back with the river. And I say that because one of the things I think we've been lucky to have is continuity over a 30-year period. And it really takes that sort of time to start to change cities. Other things we need to do is Melbourne was not designed with public spaces. I don't know the theory behind it. It was a gold rush city. There's talk about they didn't want a lot of people gathering in one place. So we've had to refit it for open spaces. And much of our philosophy can be seen in this slide here. We cut a hole in the town hall. That used to be a window, so we brought it down to ground. We put fantastic paving down, bluestone. We built a little cafe, or designed a little cafe, using private money and a 30-year lease, elevated from the street, and we put a flower cellar in, very low rent for, so that they became our passive policemen. And most of what we've done has been on that level. We've gone through the city, hundreds of times, changing traffic islands into places where people can sit. Taking a city square that won a whole lot of architectural awards and was opened by the Queen, but didn't work because there was no activity onto the square. Public spaces are only as good as the stuff that surrounds them. All the architectural gymnastics, we had amphitheatres, we had water walls, we had big screens, we had all of this. But there was no activity that actually generated action back in the square. So what we did is I convinced the mayor of the day to sell the square off to there, reinvest that money back in the theatre, open up the theatre, which is the Regent Theatre. It was a joint venture we did with the state government, and build a hotel onto the square that had cafes and restaurants on the lower level, and we designed a cafe that this photograph's taken from. And suddenly you had people who would come and sit there because you could get a cup of coffee. It was a pleasant place to sit. So this is what was happening to our open spaces, 83, 93, 2004, 2011. We've slowly been adding back the public space into the realm. We've been taking the streets and trying to get some uniformity in paving treatment. So there's only one paving treatment you can use in the city. It's the bluestone. That's what we had in 85, 2004, 2014. Why is that important? It's a fantastic walking surface. If someone comes and digs it up, you can get exactly the same material and replace it, so you never know you've been there. And it's a large module, and it's slightly dark, so you don't see all the chewing gum. You can put all the rest on top. You can put the cafes, the signage, the artworks. All of that can go on top. And we have various programs of artworks, both temporary and permanent, plus obviously the street art, which Melbourne's become quite well known for. On top of that, we've designed furniture that's designed to last for 50 years. It's robust, it's stainless steel, it's easy to clean. And there's a suite of furniture that we've designed that is now becoming part of the city's theme. Whether it's toilets, that's an Exilu toilet from New Zealand, but we've clad it in a style similar to some of the others. The telephone companies with their gear up there, paying for an information system, and even small distributors for newspapers. They used to have a midday paper in Melbourne, and they used to sit on plastic milk crates. So we designed these little operable units for them. They stopped distributing the midday paper, so it's now become quite nice as a crèmerie, just opposite the town hall. So the idea of being able to reuse that stuff, and the chairs, the fountains, the lights, even the handrails, and very simple details, was all about showing some care for that public realm. And trees. We decided we would plant trees in just about every location we could. So these are the trees we planted in the central city since 1993. And then we started to populate the streets. Once you had people coming back, coffee is a bit of a theme in Melbourne. For those of you who have been there, we pride ourselves on our coffee. But selling fruit, flowers, etc. on the streets. And this is what happened to sidewalk cafes. There were two in the 1980s, which you can see there. And now we've got 534 of them. So people associate the street with a place where you stop, you linger, you have a cup of coffee, you meet people, and they've become places that people enjoy. We've tried to do it in our own character, and Ricky mentioned the lanes and arcades, and a lot of people come to us and say, you've done a fantastic job with the lanes, and we want to put them into our city. The lanes were there. We didn't actually put them in. They were actually the product of subdivision. The blocks in Melbourne are 200 metres by 100 metres, divided by a 10-metre street and a 30-metre street on either side. And the reason we've got lanes and arcades is you can make money by subdividing the block into small properties, and then you had to have access, so you put a lane or an arcade through. All we did was, in the 20th century, it recognised that they were being lost. You were getting consolidation that was coming in, and you were getting one large building, this building by Ian Pei. And I mention his name not to actually pour scorn on it, but to say that if you don't recognise the culture of a place, you can kill it. And what's happening here is you're getting these internalized shopping centers that were taking away from the streets. So what we did in 85 is said, you can't do that anymore. You've got to externalize. You have to have 75% active frontage. This is the same shot a few years later. We convinced them they could make more money out of having bars and cafes along there rather than a concrete wall. And we inherited this fantastic lane system. All we did was legitimize people using it. So lanes that weren't that occupied but had some retail, we started to allow people to actually sit on the footpaths, very low rentals, and people started to enjoy the lanes as a nice place to be. So without having to pedestrianize the city, these were already areas that were pedestrian, and we've got this pedestrian network without having to close off some of the major streets. The local character was also about keeping some of the heritage, keeping the street frontage, and this was a block that we took where we argued that it was Commonwealth Government, they didn't have to play by the planning laws. I've never worked out why that's the case. We said, well, maybe if they kept an envelope around the edge, there's a footprint in the middle, they could develop it. Fortunately, it was for Telstra. The GM of Telstra was an enlightened person, and that's exactly what he gave a brief to the architect. So buildings were going to be knocked down, got kept. The old and the new came together. That meant you had different rental structures, different uses, and you got a better combination out of the block. It led me to believe, and this is from the strategy plan, that there are only a few things that you need to have in a planning scheme. And I infuriate our planners by every now and again saying they should take the planning scheme and throw it away. And then ask yourself the question, what is it you're trying to achieve? And if you're trying to achieve a good street in a healthy city, well, maybe you need to build up to the street frontages, you need to look after your heritage buildings. Where you've got height limits, hang on to them, because they actually give more sun penetration into those. And maybe a few simple things would be far better than these tomes of legalistic chapters that even I don't understand. So we started to work with the street and started to talk not about architecture, but about the character of the place. How do you actually keep what was a vertical style, because there's a 40-meter height limit? This is a very comfortable relationship. One of our best-known modern architects working within that. So this is also a good relationship. So it's about how do you actually fit into history, something that Frank Gehry, I think, got right in Prague. And then take that and say, with the new developments, is that possible? So this is a site we bought, and it was a hospital site. The state government sold it to a developer who knocked down most of the heritage buildings and quadrupled its value and sold it to the government in Nauru, who were going into bankruptcy, and we thought we'd better buy it because it's going to end up in tears. So we bought the site for $36 million, packaged it up by saying we wanted 20% open space, we wanted lanes and arcades, we wanted a different architect to deal with the different parcels, and we didn't want a single large development. And that's what effectively happened. So we got this modern piece of Melbourne that sat there and predominantly was successful in achieving some of the characteristics. Fed Square was a competition, and one of the reasons this competition, this entry won, was it reinterpreted the lanes and arcades of Melbourne. It was a campus as opposed to a large building, and what happened is the Premier added an art gallery, which is the building on the back, right halfway through the competition, and this one could just shuffle up and accommodate it, and in the end won the competition. Connectivity is really about how we get around the city. We've had quite an aggressive policy of getting the car out of the city. The main street that ran through, we closed in 1992. It gave priority to bicycles, trams, etc. The street was dying. People forget how bad the street was. And by simply widening the footpaths by 3.5 metres on either side, not taking all the traffic out, taking some of it out, planting 100 trees, we were able to move the pedestrian numbers over 10 years from 12,800 to 25,000. And today there are 65,000 people that walk down Swanston Street every day. It's one of the better known streets. And this is a recent upgrade we've had where we've improved the tram stops, tried to give people some dignity in the way they use public transport. Decent shelters, places to sit, information, people have now started to get back onto the public transport system seriously. Bicycles, we started a fairly aggressive campaign with bicycles in the year 2000 when we had about 1%. These are some of the bike routes that are being built. The main bridge that crosses St Kilda Road, which is a boulevard, we took, there are only two traffic lanes in each direction. We took one out and gave it to bicycles, and the world was going to come to an end. And unfortunately, it didn't. Or fortunately, it didn't. And we've actually got to the stage now where this is a bridge we designed to connect the bike route in Royal Park. We started with fairly crude, separated routes, and we've gone from 1% in 2002 to 12% by 2013, and I think that's up to about 14% now. Public participation. A lot of what we do depends on bringing our community with us, and I think we're not really good at that quite often. One of the things that's happening in Australia is experiencing climate change before most countries. Not that our Prime Minister would have noticed it. We suffered what people refer to as the 11-year drought, and we look to lose about 48% of our trees in 20 years, and that's just plotting the life expectancies of our trees. What you see here, you can see the period of drought coming up in brown there. Never before had we had this sustained drought. And it led us to realise that if we didn't start doing something about it, we were going to lose our urban landscape. And I mentioned earlier, I divided the parks and gardens, and I set up what was known as the Urban Landscapes Unit, working with the urban designers. More people are dying in Melbourne during those hot periods than die in the fires. So you hear about the 173 who tragically died in the fires. At the same time, 374 died just of the heat wave conditions. So we put in place two strategies, an urban forest strategy and an open space strategy. What are we trying to do? We're trying to look at the heat island effect of the central city and mitigate that. We know that if we plant trees, we can drop temperatures by up to 4 degrees. Putting the strategy in place, had we talked about trees and what type of trees, we'd still be talking. Because people are passionate about trees. You know, indigenous, introduced, you know, this tree, that tree. We decided we wouldn't talk about trees at all. We'd talk about the percentage of canopy cover. So you can see the strategy here talks about going from 22% to 40% by 2040. It talks about diversity. It talks about health of vegetation, improved soil moisture. And that strategy was adopted. Once it was adopted, you could then go out and put in place the tools that allow you to have a conversation with your community. So we've got a website, so if you get to Melbourne, or you can Google it from here, you can have a look at our urban forest. And each tree is identifiable. In fact, you could send it an email. In fact, if you're lucky, you'll have a conversation. This was about a football fan who was feeling a bit dehydrated, and the tree Googled him back or emailed him back saying knew exactly how he felt. So we then can go to the community and start talking to the community about the sorts of trees that they want. They can get the information on the website. They can look at different tree species, colour, indigenous, exotic. They can even look at the priorities in which they want to do the streets in their area. I don't expect you to read it back there, but these are high-density streets. These are community-identified priority streets, hot and very hot streets from our Google. So they actually got to look at the streets and decide which of those they wanted to prioritise. Integrated action was really about working with all levels of government, and this is something that doesn't happen very often. But because we've got very little power, we've got to do a lot of what we do through advocacy. So schemes like this, which was for the Commonwealth Games, is a redundant railway bridge that we're going to knock down. We got them to keep it, close a road that came through here, create two public spaces, and give us a new link across the river. We then turned that link into a celebration of our multicultural community. The sculptures on the bridge actually represent different periods of migration, with the 10 of them, with one on the land being the indigenous community who had been there all the time. And then each country had a glass screen with, you know, how many people lived in Melbourne, where they came from, what period they came from. So this became an educative thing as well as a pedestrian walk. In our parks and gardens, we've got a fantastic set of parks and gardens. We look to actually want to join these parks up, because you can see the size of that park system, which people aren't aware of, because this is called Carlton Gardens and this is Treasury, and they've all got different names. We looked at that, and the connection was really cut off by a lot of railway lines. You can see the large building, this doesn't seem to work on there, in front of the cathedral was knocked down. This was an aspirational diagram we did in 86. We wanted to go from there to there, get a continuous connection. On the back of Federation Square, we managed to convince the Premier of the day that if he removed all but the running lanes, of which there were 12 that ran through there, we could get an 8-hectare piece of parkland through there. And to his eternal credit, that's exactly what he did. He was decisive enough to go out the next day and just say to the public transport people, I want you to move those lines. And you know what? They just did it. And you got a park, and all the traffic went out to the end of the line, which is mostly the best place for it to be anyway, and where the land was cheap. This was a public one that I mentioned. We did this with the state government. Water. Part of our challenge at the moment is water. We've got a policy of our city as a catchment. You can see what's happening to our water. It's actually halved as we get towards climate change. So we now capture everything that falls on the city as far as possible. That's the aim. Whether it comes directly off the street into the tree pits, we've got large tanks where we collect it. This is a 5 milliliter tank in one of our historic gardens where we had a depot. We halved the depot in site, rationalised it, built the tank, and returned it to parkland. This is the tank. under streets.
We dug up the streets, we put a couple of tanks under here, we put a rain garden on the top of it, and that actually purifies the water and puts it back into the gardens.
And we've got traditional wetlands where we collect water from a whole area here that runs down into this park system. We're now doing 20% of the water in our city. We've got things like permeable paving. We've got a catchment where we're looking to stop the overland flow because it floods the downtown every 10 years. I want to end on adaptability because part of what I think we need to do with our cities is think about how we, in fact, reimagine them. And we've been doing a lot of that, you know, in the 80s. We took street systems and we started stealing the asphalt. We've taken 46 hectares of asphalt out of the central city by widening footpaths, putting medians and planting trees, taking the parking off one side of the street and then putting that on the footpath on the other side of the street. That's exactly the same place there. Giving people room to walk so they can walk with some dignity and therefore can do some shopping. Digging up hard areas and planting trees, you know, whether they're down the middle of a road. This is one of our challenges because we're not getting the money through developer contributions. We took a traffic island that was 500 square metres and turned it into a park that's just about 5,000 square metres simply by just putting a one-way system around that traffic island. That would have cost us $14 million had we gone and bought the land. In fact, it cost us $2 million to create. So a lot of what we're doing at the moment is trying to actually repurpose our infrastructure. And you can see the park there happens to be next to a little school, so you know the community's delighted with the fact that they've now got this open space. And because we're in a heritage area, we have to have a memory of where the traffic island went, which you can see there. We've changed also in terms of you know, our emphasis is much more on sustainability. We looked at targets that we needed to reduce greenhouse gases from, and I haven't got time to go through those, but one of the ways of doing it was taking you know, one of our markets, our heritage market, and putting a huge photovoltaic panel on it. All the buildings we designed, this is one of the many libraries we've designed, are now low energy. Here we're using the, you know, the ground heat source as a way of moderating the temperatures. Simple, this is an adventure playground where kids come after school to play, green roofs, solar panels, recycled containers, a veggie garden. So at a very young age, they're starting to work with you know, ways of actually being more sustainable. Simply painting the roofs of buildings. This was working with an academic at Melbourne University. And building the first six-star Green Star commercial office building in Australia. Really, the only thing that did was recognise that Melbourne had very hot days and very cool nights. So if you wanted to keep the temperature where those yellow lines are, the biggest part of this technology is open the windows and allow the cool air to come in and heat cool down this concrete ceiling, which is part of the ventilation system. The biggest challenge is retrofitting the existing buildings. So we've got what we call the 1200 buildings program, where we've refinanced. We found a mechanism whereby if you put a debt against the mortgage, against the rates on a property, that gets drawn down before the mortgage. So we're able to get very low interest capital through the banks in sort of triumvirate and allow people to invest in retrofitting their buildings. This is what's happened in our city. All of that stuff that we're talking about comes back, and I thought if I was in the LSE, we had to come back to money. That our rates have dropped from 13 cents in the dollar to just over 4. Not that we're taking any less money out, but with a greater population and not having to build all that infrastructure, we're actually running our city more efficiently. And that in many ways is the secret of where I think our cities are going. Because this is what's happening to Australian cities. They're dividing. This is called the Vampire Study. It's vulnerability of mortgage prices and house prices. You can see 2001 to 2006, and the same for all the capital cities. This happens to be Melbourne. We're getting more and more people on the fringe of our cities who cannot afford
to live there.
And this is a very short study, a very short presentation of a long study. If you want to Google it, it's called Transforming Australian Cities. And what happens in Australia is when you want to expand a city, you just go and take some more farmland and just move people further and further out. What intrigued me was this fantastic infrastructure. This is the tram infrastructure and that's the bus infrastructure. And there's a rail infrastructure that sits across the top of this. And the challenge was, if we use that infrastructure a little better, could we actually improve things? And we've actually chewed up 89 million hectares of land since the 1980s in expanding our cities. The inspiration, in a way, came from my alma mater, which is Cape Town University. When I arrived there in the mid-60s, there were about 5,000 students. All the universities were expanding. Cape Town couldn't expand because it was surrounded by national parks. So what they did, as they went to 15,000 or close to 15,000 students, is they asked themselves the question, how well are we using the stuff we've already got? And lecture theatres were being used for 17.5% of the day. So they reprogrammed. They re-timetabled. And when I went back 40 years after I'd left, the only thing I noticed was the vibrancy of the place. It was alive from 8 in the morning until late in the afternoon. So the question to myself was, if you could actually treble the population with very little building, and the outcome of that was vibrancy, why couldn't you do that to cities? So we did a study, ended up calling it the 7.5% city, and I'll show you why. We looked at putting the population in and around infrastructure, in and around railway stations. There's nothing new about that. That's something that everybody's known about. 3% of the land, if you actually just drew a line without taking any more of the residential area, and you went no higher than 8 stories and you used 60% of the land, the available floor area in there, you'd get 860,000 people living within walking distance of a train in Melbourne. That's how many railway stations we've got. That's how many small cities we've got around these railway stations. If you then, for the next 3%, went to your land-based public transport system, which is buses and trams, and you can see the system there, it's fairly comprehensive. We took a 16-minute headway, so a bus or tram had to come within 16 minutes. And we went out and looked at every parcel of land adjacent to one of those. There are 1.5 million parcels in Melbourne at that stage. This was done in 2009. And if you took out the city centres and the railway stations, you could see where you started to get the properties that fronted just onto that infrastructure. Took out some of the other sensitivities. You'll notice the number of sites dropping as we go here. Less park, less public use. We try to find an alternative point of access. So if you have an 8-storey building, you didn't have a big black hole for an entrance into a car park. Recently developed sites, heritage buildings, and 50% of any property that fell into a heritage overlay area, and small sites, less than 6 metres. We ended up with 34,000 sites, and if you put a reasonable density on, something that you would find half the density of Vienna, you get 2.4 million people living along that public transport system. We put in at 450 people per hectare, and that's not taking the roads, that's just the property. You're starting to get up to, so I threw this in because this is a completely unitised development that's gone up in Melbourne by a tram track, made in the factory and went up in a matter of months on that site. This is the sort of density you're talking about, and Vienna has twice that density in many of its streets. So you're not talking about incredible densities. This is what we're looking at. We're looking at this expensive infrastructure, and this is the fabric that sits alongside it. Here's the centre of the city. So you're within very close distance. And the imagine is, on those properties, you could get development of this sort. The last 1.5% you get out of known redevelopment sites, the greenfield sites, and you can get 500,000 people out of that quite easily. And in fact, since we did the study, they opened up a whole new area just close to the central city called Fisherman's Bend, which would make that figure even greater. So this is what it looked like. You went along those routes, you started developing along those routes, you did some infill sites on the greenfield sites, you didn't touch the land in between. They became your new green wedges. So politically, the challenge here was... Sorry, I'll go back. Politically, the challenge here was you could go to 92.5% of the people and say, we're not going to invade suburbia.
You can walk out to your area, you can find a high street, you can get a dentist, a doctor, maybe part-time employment. But you can actually keep this. This is the new green wedge. This is where you can put solar panels on the roof, plant more trees, capture water. We haven't been able to get into policy, but the developers are smart enough to know that this actually works. So what we're starting to get is developments dropping in along the tram routes. This little fellow here is 240 people per hectare. When you walk down the street, it disappears. This is some of the development that's happening along there. Might not win an architectural prize, but you're starting to get a lot of density close to a public transport system that's been backpacking for customers. So the idea of actually starting to get patronage is quite important. This was an open deck car park on the ground. It's now affordable housing, childcare, supermarket, and community building, community services. Starting to actually front onto the street. So people, this would be like Roehampton and places like this. This was, towers in green space. These people now have an identity back to the street. They're part of the community. The costs of doing that, if you come back in, you build on the infrastructure, lost the name at the moment, but it's a well-known consultancy has done the study. They actually showed that for every 1,000 houses you built, you saved $300 million over 50 years in infrastructure. That's $440 billion as you double Melbourne's population if you come back in on yourself. You can do it on 7.5% of the land. We're arguing about whether we can afford one national broadband scheme in the whole of Australia. We could get 12 out of those savings in Melbourne alone. So there's the challenge. As we come back in, can we in fact be smarter about the stuff we're building? Can we in fact use the infrastructure we've got? And there's a much longer presentation, which I haven't got time. When you ask our architectural faculty, this is the University of Melbourne, what new urbanism in Australia is going to look like, and this went off to the Venice Biennale. This is what they showed. It's an embarrassment. It's actually dangerous. This is living by the sea, and this is suburbia. There's a reality, and I think we've got to start thinking about the reality. As you increase the densities in our cities, streets like this that have public transport in them can in fact become streets like this, where you have a new railway station being proposed, you can get this sort of level of urbanism around us. The reality is, little streets like this with the city at the end there, what will they look like in 20 years' time? You can see the tram poking its nose down here. They're mostly going to look a bit like this. We're going to have planted more trees, there are going to be solar panels, they're going to be collecting water, and there'll be 5 or 6 stories along the tram route. You can sell that to a population. They actually understand that and believe that they wouldn't mind living in that. The other stuff, they'll fight you every step of the way. Thanks very much.
Tom, thank you for that. We have time for some questions and discussion. One thing would just strike me, you used language throughout your talk as if the city is a human being. I mean, you actually talk about it in a very, very... you started with contraception. You talked about the danger. If you don't do certain things, you kill it. You talk about the city as vampire. I mean, it's very much as a metabolism. Right? And I'm sort of struck by... Well, I would say most people in... position, and I used the term before, technical in charge would be shy away from that, because also, and clearly this links to the notion of communication, which you touched upon at the end. Can you say a bit more about that?
Look, I hadn't thought about that, but my initiation into urban design, I did mention 1969, if you come over from Africa and you're a fourth year student and you've heard about all the places you should go and visit, and then you start visiting them, and there were places like Stevenage or Albertslund in Copenhagen, and you didn't have to be an architect to know that you wouldn't want to live there. You know, there was something in your gut that just told you, I would not pay money to live here. And so my entry into urban design has been very much a gut reaction. And I have this feeling that, in fact, all of us are urban designers. In fact, I don't like urban design as a profession. Urban design should be the first 3 years of university before you actually become a specialist. You know, the medical faculty, if we told them we're going to do brain surgery before we did general practitioner, they would be horrified. Yeah. But that's what we do in architecture. We take architects, landscape architects, planners, and we give them a specialized degree before we've actually given them the undergraduate degree, which is the city, the place they're going to work in. So I see, you know, the urban experience and urban design as something that every one of us experiences and understands. And hence, I think, the way I speak about it. I don't expect anybody not to understand the emotions I feel for it.
I'm beginning to understand what you mean by unplugged.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Can you wait for a microphone? Just say who you are, that would be helpful.
Thanks. I'm Ben Plaid and I work for Transport for London, so very interesting to hear how you've planned ahead around transport. Ricky mentioned governance in his introduction. You implied in your talk that you're having to do this largely through influence rather than because you control much of this. Yeah. Can you say a bit more about the way that the different tiers of government are structured?
Yeah, sure.
And insofar as that hinders you, how have you overcome the fact that you, for example, not the planning authority, but nonetheless you're clearly having a big influence on how planning works? How have you got around those institutional blocks?
Sure. You've got three levels of government in Australia. The federal government has almost no involvement in cities at all, tragically. They had a cities unit under Labor. It had five people in it and was disbanded under the Conservative government. The second level is the state government. And the state governments were the original governments in Australia. You got states before you got federalism. They are very strong. And they obviously sit in the capital cities and therefore take quite a strong interest in the capital cities. We get to determine everything under 20,000 square metres. Everything above 20,000 square metres goes to the state. So that's the way it divides. So when it gets to very big developments, we really have to advocate for a voice in that decision. And we've done that by setting up partnerships with the states. In fact, in the last couple of years, we've done between $15 and $20 million worth of work for the state government, actually delivering their projects, because they've actually de-skilled themselves to the extent that they can't deliver some of those projects anymore. So we've actually got this rapport now with the state, and they tend to ask us our opinion. They won't always follow it, but they'll ask us our opinion. And on very sensitive issues, they would usually accept it. So it's that sort of dialogue. And we deal with them quite intimately. I've come to understand, I never thought I'd be a bureaucrat. I didn't go to get into government. It was a mistake. The contact you've got at local government is direct. You know who your constituents are. You can have a conversation with them. As you get further up in government, you get further away, and you become removed from that decision-making. I'm fascinated by the fact that they're going to start devolving power to places like Manchester. I think that's a really good idea. I think the city level is starting to understand what you need to do with cities. If you look at what's coming out of C14, which is a group of 40 cities, that's where you're getting sustainability. That's where you're getting social cohesion being discussed. So, I really think there's quite an interesting thing happening at the moment as the national governments don't want to get involved in cities. To actually start devolving that more down to cities is quite interesting.
But just to take this further, there are these three very different levels, and I mean the responsibilities are quite clear. How have you been able to actually operate across these levels? I mean, a lot by stealth.
A lot by stealth. I mean,
through projects, maybe that's one of the key things.
Well, for instance, if you want to steal asphalt, just don't do it in big chunks.
because then the road authority doesn't notice. You know, they just think you're fiddling at the edges.
Right.
But you're widening the footpaths, you're putting down medians, and try not to do it on roads that they worry about. Do it on roads that they're not as worried about. So some of it's by stealth. I'm an incrementalist, so a lot of ours is, you know, 300 small little projects a year rather than one big one. I'm not a believer in actually saying, you know, the way we're going to change the city is by having one of those big things, because I must be there in 10 years still trying to achieve it. So a lot of ours is incremental, hence the reason we measure it, because we would have forgotten many of the projects we've done on the way through.
No, I mean, I was going to come to, I mean, the mere fact that you have these maps which just measure what you've done, and you can represent it, I think, is actually fundamental.
I'm Nigel Hugill. Amongst other things, I like to think of myself as a developer. I enjoyed your speech very much, but I was left a little confused because I hadn't expected somebody from Melbourne to be speaking out against tall buildings. And in your concluding piece, you said that it was very difficult to persuade people to get permissions, but on the other hand, you appeared almost to be bemoaning the level of tall building consents in the central core. And so what I wasn't sure in that ambivalence was whether you were objecting to the fact that there wasn't a contribution back to the city in relation to the planning consents, or whether or not the scale of itself was objectionable. Because a lot of what you seem to be saying seem to be contingent upon getting more people into the centre. And if nothing else, consents of that nature are at least keeping down prices from where they would be otherwise.
No. Let me clarify. I'm not against tall buildings per se. What we thought we'd done in 85 is put in place a planning framework that would have meant if you want a tall building, as you would in New York, at certain stages you set back from the street to protect downdrafts, sun into the street, etc. What's happened in Melbourne is the minister has actually thrown all of that out, and he allows very tall buildings straight off the street. That's what I object to. Not tall buildings per se. You've picked up an uncertainty in my own philosophy, because I do like the population that's coming in. So the density that comes from a lot of those tall buildings is a good thing. It's driving the economy. There's only one certain thing in the world today, and that is that there's going to be growth in many cities. I mean, it's the only form of growth you could guarantee, I think, in the next 40 or 50 years. So I'm in favour of that. But I think you need to do it in a way that doesn't compromise the quality and amenity of the public realm of the city you're working in. And particularly if you're in a city like Melbourne, where we've got a lot of land, you don't have to, in fact, take those very narrow sites and build them up, you know, to 50 or 60 stories. There are enough big sites to, in fact, if there was a setback on that one I showed you, it wouldn't have been viable and it wouldn't have been developed. And we thought that's what we had in the system. So you would have got a combination of the small buildings being kept and some of the other development taking place. So I think it's a lack of rigor that I'm opposed to at the moment, rather than an opposition just to tall buildings.
There's a question coming up here, but just show me your hand if there's anyone else. That side I can't see. Sorry. Okay. Over here, fine. Okay, thank you. I just want one PR statement. You showed that picture of the models in the Venice Biennale, which, of course, I like, and in terms of communication. But it's just very interesting that in the room, in the back, is one of our former students who actually was the author of the first density maps we did and made those models, basically, Bruno. So it's nice to...
Well, congratulations, because I, you know...
Just so happens.
The simplicity of communication, that to me was one of the most profound moments of walking in that room, because we talk about density, but it's a funny thing, you know... What does it look like?
The tall building.
You know, is it tall or is it square? When you walked in that room, suddenly, because you'd been to Barcelona and you'd been to London, and you suddenly thought, what's happening here? It was a fantastic exhibition.
Peter Murray, New London Architecture. I'd like to carry on that discussion about the taller buildings, because you showed a tall building on a podium with a setback with activity at street level, rather sort of Vancouverish sort of way. Does that work in terms of the street level and also from a development point of view, satisfying what the developer wants to need?
I think it does. Again, you've got to talk of the context you're working in. Melbourne, up until the 1960s, was a 40-metre city. The reason it was 40 metres, that was the height of a fireman's ladder, so they just stopped it at 40 metres. After the Olympics, we now are a modern city, and those height limits were taken away. It always occurred to me that if you hang on to the 40 metre as a limit, that if you, once you got above that, you needed to set back slightly, you would have kept the general character of the city. While allowing you to have modern tall buildings. And that's the thing that I really was in favour of. And many of the buildings right up until a few years ago did exactly that. You saw that set in Docklands. They actually went up not quite 40 metres but then set back. You got people at those lower levels opening up onto, you know, the public realm, you know, eyes on the street, you know, and you got sun penetration and the wind was mitigated by the top of the podium. So I think that can work. Architects get as frustrated as hell about podiums because it's not a very elegant form. You know, can you imagine the cheese grater with a podium? Mm-hmm. You know, it wouldn't quite be the same building. And so there's this tension
between... I think you need to amplify that little statement. What is the cheese grater and what are you talking about?
Well, you know, Richard Rogers' building that comes down...
He does, but not everyone else.
Yeah, it comes down to the street. A hugely elegant building. Now, I'm sure if he had been, you know, asked through planning to actually put that on a podium to mitigate the wind, he's mostly done it through the canopy anyway. I don't know the wind impact around that. It changed the nature of it. So there's this tension between the architect and the urbanist as to what constitutes a good street. And that's going to always be a lively debate, and I welcome it. But I think they need to come together and understand that it's the way the building hits the ground that really matters. And you can do that successfully or unsuccessfully.
So one here and then over there.
Hello, Rob. I'm Naveta, an urban designer who's having lived in the inner suburban ring in Melbourne. I can quite appreciate the ambition that you have for intensifying those urban corridors, especially along tram lines. But what's the strategy that's put into place in terms of public transport planning to actually cope with those densities now, and especially to try and sort of connect up some sort of orbital systems rather than sort of procreating the radial system that Melbourne currently has?
Yep. My understanding of that, and I don't for the moment sell myself as being a transport planner, but what fascinated me when I looked at Melbourne is that you had this grid of buses that ran across a radial tram and rail network. And my simple assumption is if you get the timetabling so the buses arrive at the station or the tram stop, you know, a few minutes before the tram or the train left, that you wouldn't need an orbital system, that you actually had a system that was moving like this and connecting those. And, you know, the technology we now have enables us to do that. You know, people in Melbourne are scared of buses because they're never quite sure where it's going to end up. And the way the bus system has been set up, it's been a whole lot of separate companies who have a franchise for one sector and another sector over here. So until we get to the stage where the technology and the physical infrastructure actually get together and you can actually get to the station at the right time a few minutes before your train, people will start talking about radial systems. I don't think they're necessary. I think we've got enough infrastructure in Melbourne. What we need to start doing is on the tram routes, we need to start getting the cars off the tram routes so the tram actually runs quickly and efficiently. And you could do that because the tram routes are quite far apart. There are plenty of other roads on a grid system a car can take. So I think it's about repositioning it rather than actually building more.
Only because I think the next head of transport in Melbourne is sitting there.
Yeah, then
we'll come to you on the other side in a moment. I think you next.
Thanks, Ricky. Jerome Weimar, formerly of TfL, and about to go to Melbourne in January to help you with your work. Related to transport, I guess, but you've talked a lot about the central part of Melbourne.
Yep.
What's the relationship like with the surrounding suburbs? How do you interact with them? Is there a competitive dynamic, or is it something that you come together on to do the wider metropolitan area?
We've, of our own volition, joined up with the inner city councils. So we have a thing called IMAP, Inner Metropolitan Association of Planning. And that is because our infrastructure just crosses over. I mean, we share one of the boulevards with a neighbouring council. So the trees on one side of that road are theirs, and the trees on the other side are ours. You know, that's the ridiculous nature of some local government. So to have that relationship with your neighbouring council is quite important. So we've for some years now, joined up with the inner city municipalities to try and get some logic into that inner city. One of the good things about Plan Melbourne, which has just been brought in by the state government, is it takes the central city, which is IMAP effectively, and then takes four other wedges and puts them together as planning regions. And I might not say it in a Melbourne audience, but you must have got the first possible conglomeration of municipalities into five larger areas that would make sense. They fall within catchments, they have a cross-section of the transport there. You could actually plan sensibly within those.
There is a Stalinist plan to reduce the 33 boroughs of London into five, but I don't think it will ever happen.
Hi, my name is Ode. I'm from the Cities Program here. I was wondering if you had a clear explanation or rationale behind why retrofitting empty buildings in the city centre was so successful in the early 80s?
Yeah. I think sometimes you get lucky. And I think when we set out in 85 and said we wanted 8,000 residential units within 15 years, I've got to be honest, we had no idea of how we were going to achieve it. And I'm a great believer in setting targets. That I think once you set a target, you're almost obliged to hit that target. What happened in the 80s was what happened in many cities. You got overbuilding of commercial office buildings. And when the property market crashed, the rentals went down, and people who had been in B and C grade office buildings were able to move out to the A grade because the rentals were much the same as they had been paying. So we had these empty buildings sitting there. What we then did was put together a program that could show the owners of those buildings that there was a possibly much better financial use for them than sitting on them for 10 years until the commercial cycle came back. And that was very simply the concept of designing off the plan. So you wouldn't have to actually spend money retrofitting a building. You design the units within a building. You would then sell them at a 10% deposit to people who are going to live in the building. The benefit for the person buying it is that they paid the tax on the undeveloped value rather than the developed value. So they saved themselves $3,000 to $5,000 on the way through. And we gave certain incentives like giving back the planning fees and the building fees. We actually had a building surveyor who went around and worked with developers to show them how they could retrofit these buildings. What we did is actually make buildings that were going to be redundant attractive as redevelopment options to the extent that people made a lot of money out of converting these buildings to residential. So it was a combination of a lucky circumstance of these buildings being empty, but then being able to package it together in a way that it made attractive for the developers to go in there.
Well, we probably have time for a couple more questions, but you talked about people making lots of money. I mean, I think there is... a sort of sense, you haven't had time to talk about this, but the notion of inequality in a city like Melbourne must be, I don't know whether it's severe, but it's certainly present. What have you been able to do about that? What shape does it take? Is there a pattern to that inequality, and is it spatialized? And how do your interventions change that? Obviously, yeah. Transport does, yeah. But more development doesn't necessarily, who is it for?
Well, to a certain extent, we exacerbated the problem when we started off. When we started Postcode 3000, we gentrified the city. And at the time, we were trying to get a residential population in, but we pushed people who were mostly in boarding houses and that out. to that extent...
Is there a social housing policy? Is there social, like we have in London?
There is, and the state government provides social housing, but they haven't built much social housing for a few decades. So, you know...
So there isn't one?
Yeah, at the moment, it's fairly stagnant. We've started to get back into that. We've taken a number of our properties. I didn't actually stop on the slide, but there was one building there where we had an old drill hall. We got into an arrangement with a housing association whereby the federal government had a program whereby if you could get 25% of the value, they would actually lend you on favourable terms 75%. So we gave them the building. They went and borrowed the other 75, and then they leased the building back to us for 100 years.
There's still quite a lot of work. A lot of work to do on that front.
There's a lot of work to do on that. So we managed to get some back in.
Okay, very brief because we need to try. So maybe we'll take their two together. So one after each other. Yeah.
My name's Mark Ames. Thank you for a very interesting presentation, and you should write a book. Within Australia, the sort of image that everyone has of where they would like to live over the past 50 years has been that sort of quarter-acre block with the room for the kids to play in the yard and, you know, the veranda around the house, what they call the Australian dream. But it seems to me that the further out you go in order to find the space to build these plots, the poorer you're becoming in terms of access to opportunity. So is there a place for the great Australian dream, or is the sort of city being turned inside out, is poverty moving to the outskirts?
Sure. Let's take both together.
Okay. Actually, my question was quite connected to that. I'll just make one point in passing very briefly, is the slide about the rates coming in does demonstrate that actually if you have devolution of finances, sorry, Richard Brown from the Centre for London, devolution of finances, you actually incentivise businesses and residences accepting higher density, which is something, an incentive we simply don't have in the UK. But I was going to ask actually about the edge of the city, what difference the intensification in the centre is making to that farmland that was potentially under development.
I started the wrong end of that. There was a study done recently in Sydney. 61% of the population said they'd prefer to live in apartments than in a detached house. So what's happening in Australia at the moment in the capital cities is there's a change. Because people are spending up to an hour and a half one way in a motor car trying to get to work. And as those vampire studies showed, you can be on a good salary, but once you've actually paid for your petrol and your mortgage, and if you're out there, you haven't got one car. You must be two or three cars. Each one of those costing you $15,000 to $20,000, you know, to run for a year. So what's happening, although the government has opened up these broad acres, the developers are having trouble selling them, quite frankly, because what is happening, we're in a subprime market. Those houses lose value the day after you move into them. And what's happening on the sites, to make money, the sites are getting smaller, and for some bizarre reason, Australia's got the biggest houses in the world, even bigger than America. The houses are going to the borders. So all you've got is a sort of a 1 metre strip around the Australian backyard. You cannot play cricket in that backyard anymore. Might explain why we lost to Pakistan. the dream has ended. What's happening is a move back in, where people have now equated not the cost of the house, but cost of living. And cost of living includes transport and time. And health. The rates, there's a very interesting study on heart disease, and people in the suburbs are suffering greater heart disease than people in the inner city. They don't walk as much.
Other question?
I thought I was answering both.
Okay, we've got to just after 8 o'clock. Told you we would be having a comprehensive understanding of how to manage a city, and it's fascinating that you have not talked once about, we did this plan and this is what happened. And throughout your talk, you didn't say, the approach is not that. You nearly described it as if this is what's happening. And it's interesting how just that methodology of sort of involvement in terms of, it's not policy-led, it's actually sort of action-led in terms of projects first. Very much a Bohigas approach that I mentioned right at the beginning in terms of what happened in Barcelona. So coming away with one notion for me is that cities are prophylactics, which is, I'm going to think about that, in terms of actually, they can stop bad things from happening. is one of the many, many interesting ideas that, Rob, you've given all of us here. So thank you again for joining us. Thank you all.